Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Tony Salvaggio. Tony Salvaggio is an environmental sociologist at Humboldt State University. He's also the representative for the California Faculty Association that sits on the Humboldt/Del Norte Central Labor Council. He's also a board member of EPIC, Environmental Protection Information Center. He has decades of experience in grassroots environmental and social justice activism. So first, Tony, thank you for being on the program. And second, thank you for your work in the world.
Oh, thank you, Derek, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about some of the things that I'm doing on this wind project.
So tell me about what you are currently struggling with there.
Yes, and I should say that I'm speaking not in any of those capacities that you just mentioned. I'm a private citizen talking on this issue right now. I guess I'll make that clear. I'm going to be letting folks know about a project. It's a really interesting environmental battle, and it is a local battle here over alternative energy, and the name of the project is the TerraGen Wind Project. It's a project that aims to place 47 600-foot tall wind turbines, and yes, 600-foot tall wind turbines, on a place called Bear River Ridge and Monument Ridge. This is just south of the towns of Rio Dell and Scotia. This is a project that has ecological impacts, indigenous cultural resource impacts, and also impacts to the local community there. And it is something that the locals here, our local board of supervisors, is going to be voting on this project come Monday of this week. And we're, what's the date? It's like December 16th. So a little bit about this project, how I was informed of it. As I said, you mentioned earlier, I sit on the Labor Council of Humboldt Del Norte as a rep for my union. And we have a meeting once every month, and someone from TerraGen came in and pitched this project to get labor support. And it's interesting because the person that pitched the project was the former executive director of an environmental organization that I work for. We talk about the talk about that a little later. But this person came in and proposed the project to us and asked for our support, and sort of outlined the details of it, job creation, environmental benefits, and whatnot. And as a labor council, we asked the question, you know, are you going to be providing union jobs, living wage jobs? And two things that we like to focus on when asking folks who are bringing in projects to the labor council is, will you enter into a project labor agreement or a community benefits agreement? And for folks that don't know too much about these two different pieces of labor protections, a community benefits agreement are agreements that the corporation or the project funders make with the community, so that the community is basically their needs are taken care of in terms of infrastructure development, and that they have a participatory voice in the decision making of the project. Project labor agreements are things also that are included in this, and that is specific with unions, specific unions and agreements with the trades over wages, over workers, again, to make sure that working folks are paid a living wage and there's benefits and such. So those are two sort of gold standard things for labor. And at the meeting, the TerraGen reps basically came in and I'll be blunt, they gave us the middle finger in the middle of our labor temple. And they actually said, no, we are not going to agree to do a community benefits agreement or a project labor agreement because it would cost them too much money. So they left. We, you know, took the position, Labor Council took the position that we are not going to support this project. And then I got word of it also through the environmental organizations that I work for, and the environmental groups are also not in support of that project. That's sort of how this was introduced to us. TerraGen, and for folks that don't know about this project, TerraGen is a alternative energy company, and it's owned by a company called Energy Capital Partners. And that may be more familiar to folks. This is a firm with billions of dollars invested in dirty gas, oil, and power plant projects in the United States. So this project, this is a really interesting formula, as we know, is that you have the dirty oil industry, create the problem, and then they get out of the problem by creating a company that's going to solve that, and that is sort of a wind company. It's a really nefarious scheme here. So TerraGen, again owned by Energy Capital Partners, is now claiming that this is going to benefit the community for jobs and for sort of climate change resilience and whatnot.
And so can you talk a little bit about, can you take off your labor hat for a minute and put on your environmentalist hat and talk about the project from that perspective, this particular project? And then after that, can you put on your ally to indigenous people hat and talk about the project from that perspective?
Yes, I can. Regarding the environmental impacts of this project, there are so many problems with this. They submitted their draft EIR, and it outlined issue after issue with impacts. Just a few I'll highlight here. So in terms of the environmental impacts, the project's going to result in the death of a number of special status species like the marbled murrelet. It violates ESA Section 9 by harming this bird. It also will cause population level impacts to numerous species like the hoary bat, and it's going to impact efforts to reestablish the California condor. So this, the location of this wind farm is basically the I-5 corridor for birds. So think about, and for those of you from California, in terms of the traffic and goes up and down I-5, the number of folks that travel through that. This is that corridor for birds, And of course, wind projects need to be situated where places there's a lot of wind. But this is one in which will have unmitigable effects on critters here. It's understudied. Many local scientists and HSU bird experts here, they've testified in public comment that this project is unmitigable. You can't put it here because of the devastating effect it's going to have on birds. Some give us upwards of a reduction of 90% of the hoary bat population. Thinking of the ecological impacts, you're looking at 600-foot tall wind turbines, and just the cement that's going to be necessary to hold these things in the ground. You're talking 40 foot down, hundreds of acres of cement on this ridge. So there's, as I said, there are too many impacts to this. To the ecology of this place, really to mention. And the environmental impact report that TerraGen put together is a really shoddy report that doesn't necessarily outline any appropriate mitigation efforts for this project. One of those deeply flawed environmental impact reports that relies really poor science and provides no quantifiable data on, on the success of their mitigation efforts.
And before we go on, I just want to mention how the beings, how the bats and birds die from these wind energy harvesting facilities. That the windmill may look like it's turning very slowly, but the tip can be going 200 miles an hour, and it can. Creatures aren't used to beings, aren't used to things that move that fast, and they can fly into them, get hit, get killed or mangled. And then another way is that the wind pressure drops drastically immediately after the wind turbine, and any bat or bird that flies near that can suffer, their hearts explode, or their eardrums explode too. They die from a rapid change of pressure. It's really horrible.
Yeah. You know, there are certain, things in the environmental impact report that the TerraGen really failed to discuss in terms of that issue. You know, another is the light, right? We talk about light pollution at night affecting owls and other critters. They don't really even mention that, but they're going to have huge lights on those 600-foot towers because you're going to get, you know, have to deal with FAA rules and whatnot. So there are so many problems here with this project in terms of the bird shredding capacity of it. The EIR that they wrote, and I keep bringing it up because this is the only really way to challenge this is to point out the failures of their assessment to really mitigate some of these problems. And they actually make in their review that the project's going to increase murrelet population. How is a wind farm going to increase bird population? So these are things that have been contradicted by bird experts at HSU and other universities. And the real problem of this, we have county supervisors who, you know, are buying this line that we need to do carbon sequestration and mitigation efforts, and we have to do this now. They're buying their claims about you know, the benefits and not really looking at the problems here that they're going to cause. This is what I refer to as a false climate solution, right? It's almost the poster child for false climate change solutions because it impacts cultural resources, ecological resources, and community in ways that are really problematic. It creates more electricity for folks to consume. It doesn't necessarily reduce electric consumption. I think while many of us recognize that we have a climate crisis and we have to do something about it, we really need to start thinking of projects based on the principles of climate justice, where we don't place the burden of these massively scaled alternative energy projects on poor rural communities, on indigenous people, and on this sort of world-renewed site of rich biodiversity. So when thinking of alternative energy projects, climate justice is never going to come from this sort of project. As policymakers are looking at this, they're looking at this as sort of bringing in tax dollars. They're also trying to deal with some of the requirements of the state in terms of offsetting our carbon emissions. And this is sort of a dimension I think that, you know, we should talk about for a minute. You know, there are two pieces of legislation in the state of California. One is AB 32, titled the Global Warming Solutions Act. And the other is SB 350. These are called the Clean Air and Pollution Reduction Act. So these two statewide pieces are the state's attempt to deal with some of the issues around climate change. So they mandate reductions. So how this TerraGen and Energy Capital Partners are framing this is, you know, we're doing our part. Humboldt County needs to do its part to reduce carbon emissions, and this TerraGen wind project is the way to do it. So looking at this, again, it's sort of a scheme to force rural communities to take on these huge, massive, and these are massive industrial wind farms, to bear the burden again of the excesses of a consumerist culture and not really deal with the issue, and that is reducing our energy consumption. So it's a really problematic logic that the policymakers are utilizing here to get this passed. And in the environmental community, there are folks that really want this project to pass. They really feel that, you know, that the end is near, and if we don't do something now, we're going to miss out on an opportunity to reduce our CO2. And again, like I said earlier, you know, when we have a climate crisis, we need to do something about it. But this is really the first project that has been offered up here to us. And we don't need to jump on it, especially if it messes with indigenous people's sacred territory, birds, and rural communities. It's a really bad policy decision.
And before we talk more about environmental or indigenous land rights issues, there's also just Jevons paradox is about how any time a new energy source comes online, it doesn't displace old sources, it just adds to them. So this whole notion is flawed in the first place of adding wind or solar. It oil use is higher today than it was 30 years ago. It's just absurd. This is not actually helping.
Yeah, and I want to add here, you know, the claims that this wind project is going to lessen greenhouse gas emissions is totally misleading, because Energy Capital Partners is not retiring any of their dirty fossil fuel enterprises, right? There is no wash here, if you will. The project simply is just creating more electricity for people to consume, as you point out, and it doesn't really address the issue of how we live on this planet, right?
So before, thank you for that. And before we go to the indigenous questions, or the question of indigenous territory, what is the land that they are, what's the current land use for where they want to put this? Is it forest? Is it parking lot? Is it, what is it?
So it is split into two private parcels right now. The timber company owns it, and then, the Russ Ranch owns it, and those are the two current landowners of the project. So TerraGen would basically be leasing the property from both the ranch and also from HRC, Humboldt Redwood Company. Those are the two owners of the land right now. And I should point this out, that the owners of the Russ Ranch and both the folks that decided on this, and I guess maybe let me back up. There was a planning commission meeting that happened. There were three planning commission meetings that happened over this topic in the last month and a half. And at each meeting, they ran about 4 to 5 hours. The overwhelming majority of folks told the planning commission that they should deny the project, right? However, as we know with planning commission, how they're stacked, they're usually stacked with folks that are overwhelmingly pro-development. But during the planning commission hearings, the folks from the Russ Ranch and other that support the project were arguing that because they've had this property in their family for generations and they take good care of it, that this is the best use of the property rather than turning it into mansions in the hills. So they're using this logic, like we're gonna lease it out to TerraGen and we won't subdivide it. So you have to support it. And because we've been stewards of the land for four or five generations, that our claims override the claims of indigenous people, which we can get to in a minute. So yeah, it's really troubling. So the planning commission folks, they ended up denying the permit, which was really a positive thing. So they denied the permit 4-2. It was a surprising vote because so many folks came out in opposition to voice their concerns for it, and they just punted it to the Board of Supervisors. So that's sort of where we're at now with the project.
So can you talk about the indigenous, the issues associated with indigenous land now?
Yes. So the project is cited to be placed on Bear River Ridge and Monument Ridge, and these are ancestral territories of the Wiat. This ridge overlooks the entire ancestral territory, and it's visible from anywhere within Wiat territory. In the past, the ridge would have been used as a high prayer spot for the tribe, and it's a symbol. The condor, which would be impacted, is also a spiritual symbol for the tribes of both the Wiat and the Yurok. So the project itself would permanently alter the character of this tribal cultural resource for both the Wiat and the Yurok. And it's again an impact that is unavoidable. It's also going to impact the plants and the harvesting ability for the local tribe. The botanical resources are things that can't be replaced. Now, in their attempt to mitigate the impact on the botanical resources, TerraGen offered in their EIR to uproot, I think it was 100 plants, and then give them to the Wiat so they can plant them somewhere. It was so appalling that was something proposed in the environmental impact report. But, you know, here again, you know, these projects are disproportionately affecting indigenous people. And the fact that's not discussed in the deliberations is that these institutions of environmental policy, you know, the elected officials and the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission, you know, bureaucrats, they've been almost as a rule created by white folks and often remain dominated by white people. And, you know, in our community, we have made some strides in dealing with some of the power inequalities, but the legacy of racism and cultural genocide here, it continues to haunt us here in the county. And this project, for many of us, really needs to be thought of not in the context of clean energy, but in the context of the legacy of white supremacy and the sort of ongoing attempts to erase indigenous people and destroy their tribal resources. So we have in the environmental community people that are okay with that. Like, they are there saying this. We recognize that this is going to impact the Yurok and the Wiat. However, we need to do something now, and we think it's in the best interest of the tribal folks that we do this project. The chair of the Planning Commission said that. He said, you know, while we understand the impacts, it's in the best interest of the tribe to go forward with the project. So these sort of things that we consistently see in our policymakers is really troubling. You know, it's telling indigenous people that their land, again, has to be sacrificed to adequately deal with the crisis. And it's a crisis, as we know, that their culture hasn't created. You know, the whole quote-unquote, we recognize that their resources will be impacted, but your culture stands in the way of progress, right? Sound like a familiar story? It's really a step in the wrong direction, a giant step in the wrong direction. And you know, I ask, and many of us is like, haven't they given us enough already, right? Or haven't we taken enough from them already? But our policymakers are at their death, right?
So have the Wiat and the Yurok taken positions on this?
Strong positions on this. Both of them have spoken out in the Planning Commission meetings early, and also in coming up in the Board of Supervisors meeting. They've released letters and had folks discuss specifically what those impacts are on Wiat and Yurok cultural resources and landscapes. And they, in both the draft EIR and the final EIR, argue that that fails to provide appropriate mitigation measures to avoid their harms. So they urge the county, both of them, to not approve the project because of those significant and unavoidable harms. Now, I want to bring in, I brought up earlier those two pieces of legislation in California, right? I think it was SB 350 and AB 32, and I want to point to the significance of those, okay? With specifically SB 350, it allows for what is the phrase for it? I'm looking through my notes here. It's called overriding considerations. Have you heard of that concept before, Derek? Overriding considerations?
I gotta tell you, it's making me nervous.
Yeah, it is. And basically, and I'm not a lawyer, but from what I've been told by the lawyers and from reading these, is overriding considerations are ways in which projects can move forward without really addressing the impacts, because there's something that overrides those impacts.
Yep, I knew that was coming.
Yeah, it's basically bullshit. And the overriding considerations that these folks, with these meaning TerraGen and Energy Capital Partners, are arguing is that because we have a climate crisis, these are overriding considerations. Therefore, we are going to kill birds. Therefore, native land is going to be sacrificed. Therefore, the communities around us, this project, are just going to have to deal with it because of these overriding considerations. And they're utilizing one more thing. They're utilizing messaging like Greta, right? Like the folks that are over there in Spain right now saying that indigenous rights should be protected. They're using like her messaging and the messaging of the climate justice movement and co-opting that messaging to get this passed, right? We have to do something now. And it's a really nefarious sort of exercise that these folks are engaging in here. It's really horrible.
Well, there's two things. One of them is that, I don't understand how, for example, Naomi Klein doesn't seem to understand. I mean, she wrote The Shock Doctrine about how capitalism will create a crisis and then advance capitalism as the solution to the crisis, when that's exactly what is happening with so much of this climate stuff. So that's one thing. And the other is, instead of overriding concerns, if that was the phrase you used, there's another phrase that Robert J. Lifton used, which is called claims to virtue. And it's before you can do anything, any sort of nasty thing, you have to have a claim to virtue or an overriding concern that... I mean, how many of these have we gone through, you and I both, on excuses to cut down trees? Yeah, I know the forests are in bad shape, but because of forest health, we need to cut them down. Oh, because of salvage, we need to cut them down. Oh, because of fire danger, we need to cut them down. I mean, there's always an excuse for it, and this is just the excuse for more destruction.
Yeah, and this is a great example. The state includes in these pieces of environmental legislation that are supposed to really, well, in theory, effectively deal with the crisis, but they drop these things in so that their interest, meaning the interest of corporations and the politocrats, right? Those folks will be able to have a get out of jail free card, if you will, to some of these. This is the first EIR that I've read that there are so many attempts to use this statement of overriding considerations. I think there are seven points that they are hoping to use this claim. And I think in the past I've read, okay, maybe there was one overriding consideration. And one of those could be economic, right? But there's seven of them. And this is, the first, and this is the first wind project that we have up here. And it's not a good start for alternative energy projects up here. I mean, we're here in the heart of like radical environmental movements. And yet we have alternative energy advocates out here utilizing the sort of climate change rhetoric to justify a project that doesn't really address the issue. And that is, the consumptive aspect of our culture and doesn't respect indigenous rights on these things. It's not shocking at the same time.
One of the reasons that I wanted to interview you about this is not only so people know about this particular issue, but because I think people all over the world can recognize the struggle that you're going through, because this same struggle has been happening in Germany, it's been happening in the eastern United States. It's been happening all over the world, as in California, in Southern California, as grassroots environmentalists fight big energy companies. And it's the same story. I was just reading somebody not very long ago in, I don't know if I remember, it was Massachusetts or Maine. It's on the East Coast. And it's this huge offshore wind energy harvesting facility. And the environmentalists were freaking out, at especially the other environmentalists who were supporting it. And they're saying, look, if this was a big oil facility, we'd all be freaking out. But because it's not, because it's wind instead, suddenly this is okay. Or there's another person said, you know, environmentalists are against batteries all the time, except when it comes to putting them in electric cars, and suddenly they're okay. And the point is that these are battles fought all over the world, and you're doing a wonderful job of articulating something that I think people are gonna recognize everywhere.
You know, in the media here, it's been taken, how do you describe it? The headlines are environmental community is, you know, in conflict here over this, and they are playing up the sort of benefits to this, and not necessarily looking specifically at, you know, the long-term impacts of this project. The coverage of it has really been leaning towards approval of the project, and getting their voices out, those folks that are arguing that, you know, we have to do this, it is too late. And it's shocking how quickly people just sort of write off legitimate concerns of native folks and of critters, so that we can keep on doing what we've been doing as a culture.
So we're about 33 minutes in. We've got like 15 minutes left. We're about two thirds of the way through. So can you talk about some of the, sort of shifting alliances that happened through this, or shifting, like you said that there was, you told me before the interview started about, one union opposed it but now supports it, and this is just, can you talk about the sort of confusing or shifting or whatever word we want to use, politics associated with this?
Yeah, this case, this TerraGen wind farm project presents an interesting case for us in understanding, I would say, the future of the climate change movement, the climate justice movement specifically. You know, we're going to be needing alternative energy projects moving forward. It's, you know, in order to reduce CO2 and at the beginning of this project, as I mentioned earlier, there was a sort of broad coalition of folks, not in the formal sense, but folks that were in opposition, and that was the labor movement, that was the communities that were going to be impacted, those rural communities where it was going to be sited, that was indigenous folks, and the sort of radical environmental movement. The environmental movement has been kind of wishy-washy on this issue from the start, and that's been a real sort of struggle for me, having feet in all these different camps. And again, the environmental movement, many were arguing that, you know, we need to do something, and you know what, indigenous labor, they're just going to have to deal with it, right? And that's sort of the classic white elitist environmental position. And that is really troubling. But we did have solidarity with labor and indigenous folks. And all the way up until the meeting, as I mentioned earlier, we had a planning commission meeting, and how the project moves forward, you get approved by the planning commission, then the board of supes, and then it's on. So what happened was the planning commission denied the applicant. So TerraGen ended up recognizing Energy Capital Partners that they weren't going to get this project through until they, you know, got some allies. So they actually went back to the table with labor and gave labor the dream contract. They signed the dotted line and everything that labor asked for, which is an amazing and fabulous accomplishment for organized labor. Rarely does this happen in these negotiations. So for workers, they were able to succeed, and just last week, labor is now in support. Labor meaning not all the labor movements, a couple unions within the labor movement that have that contract. So, you know, it's really challenging to, you know, think about, you know, one day you're standing up against this, the Board of Supervisors with your allies, and the next day they're no longer allies because the company basically bought everybody off. And this is something that's going to happen more and more in the future of the climate justice movement. So it's something that we're taking in stride right now. We're trying to shore up the environmental opposition to this, and there are folks lining up, to, you know, figure out ways to litigate this, but it's a very difficult place to be. And I should also mention, you know, the communities that are going to be impacted. These are communities that 20 years ago we were all getting arrested in. This is timber country, right? These are communities, that housed sort of, the enemy, if you will, right? Pacific Lumber, is one of the, Scotia's one of the company towns that is going to be impacted. Rio Dell, the culture has changed in the last 20 years in thinking about both environmental issues and also about maintaining wild spaces has shifted. So we are now in a place where we're going to be doing a rally in sort of timber country, and we don't really have to worry about getting arrested and beaten up by the police, because we're all in agreement that this project is horrible. So here you have indigenous folks, you have a former timber community, and you have some radical environmentalists really all mobilizing together, against this project.
It's a fascinating thing to me how there are people who get really I call it the cooties theory of politics, that if you talk to somebody that you disagree with on some issues, that that you get cooties and you become impure. Yeah. And that's not how politics works.
Yeah, and that's no way to build a future either. You know, I come from a family of auto workers. Everybody was, you know, worked in the auto plant. And I moved out west and became involved in the, you know, radical forest defense movement, and then joined an alliance. And that was called the Alliance for Sustainable Jobs and the Environment. And that was the first real blue-green alliance made up of radical unions and radical environmentalists that challenged corporate power and, you know, showed up at the WTO and then came back to our local communities and did work getting jobs in the woods. You have to remember, I think folks should remember that many of these folks in these communities are powerless. Having depended on these sort of corporations for their well-being. So, you know, it's one of those spaces where you have to recognize that there are really important issues that, you know, we need to work together on, and this is one of them, right?
So you've talked about how this is putting the costs for more industrial electricity generation onto the environment and onto indigenous people, but can you also put this within the context of these small resource extraction communities and how this is yet again you know, sort of.
So this, think about the timber wars, right? We had companies coming from out of the area, hostile takeover, specifically with just look at Pacific Lumber, right? We had Maxam came in, took over the company, increased the cut. Charles Hurwitz walks in the door. He says, what was his famous statement? He's like, he who has the gold makes the rules. I think that was what he said.
Yep.
Community, right? And what we had is we had this region treated like the periphery, where our resources at that time was timber. Extract that resource, that wealth goes somewhere else. And then we deal with all that externalities, right? Bad, you know, bad forestry decisions lead to declining salmon populations, silty rivers, just devastation, right? 20 years later, what we see now is now we see a new change in this sort of landscape in terms of energy, and we have a company coming from out of the area treating us again like a periphery, and they're saying that we want to put this project here in your community, and that we can't, there's no wiggle room. Like, we don't have the money to put less windmills. If we did less windmills and protected native sites and made them smaller, so the impact was less, then we wouldn't make our money. So you have the same sort of relationship here with these companies, these alternative energy companies coming into these rural communities and say, it's our way or the highway, right? And then where is that wealth going to be placed? Now, we had a power outages here throughout the state of California. Many folks who are on, you know, listening are from Cali, and that you may have experienced those. One of the arguments that the TerraGen and other folks are making is that this is going to make us energy independent, and then we can keep all this energy that we create from this windmill on our grid. And the reality is that this doesn't create energy independence. That energy that's created doesn't stick in Scotia. It doesn't even come here. It gets on the grid and gets shipped somewhere else, right? So if we lose power, if they cut power off again like they did for a number of days here, that we still will be out without power. They're not going to create a line that runs into our community that powers us when the state shuts off electricity, when PG&E shuts off the electricity. So it doesn't create energy independence, right? It creates, again, a carbon credit for the polluting industry somewhere else. One more point I really want to make, it's kind of like an aside, it's got something to do with cannabis, and that is indoor cannabis production in the state. As many folks know, we have legalized production right now. There's a windmill farm, industrial farm in Coachella Valley down in the south, and there are windmills all over down there. And those windmills sit adjacent next to indoor cannabis farms. And the state, of course, sanctions indoor cannabis. Cannabis can be grown outdoors. We don't need to grow it indoors. But over 50% of that energy that's generated from those windmills, and this is the low estimate, once all those indoor cannabis permits are online, it's going to go right directly into indoor cannabis. So if we want to look at it in the big picture, we are going to get these wind farms, and it's kind of subsidizing poor policy in many different areas. And cannabis is just one of them, right? We shouldn't be growing that stuff indoors in a large industrial scale. But this is what now, who has to suffer? The rural communities have to suffer through this. So we are treated as the periphery in many different ways, and this is not new to, you know, rural landscapes in terms of the treatment by the state and corporations. I want to bring it back to this topic of climate justice, you know, where we shouldn't be placing the burdens of these alternative energy projects on folks that didn't create the problems. And I think it's these energy, alternative energy folks, I'm trying to use my words politely because I have a lot of friends in this world that are alternative energy sort of cheerleaders. They have their hearts in the right place. And they understand that we need to do it, but I think they're not looking at the impacts it has on other communities. And they're not checking at the door. They're sort of white privilege and their position as powerful people in this world. And yeah.
Well, I understand your perspective, and I'm just going to say it, that there's yet again the natural world. It ends up that the economy and fueling the economy is more important than life on the planet. And that is just, and it's also more important than communities. It's more important than everything.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's a theory in environmental sociology, and it is ecological modernization theory. And it's, you know, one that is promoting this notion that to get out of the crisis, we've got to rely on science and technology to help us solve this. And, you know, while I recognize that we definitely have to look at science and technology for certain things, in this theoretical perspective, there's an over-reliance on science and technology, and there's not a critical gaze towards science and technology, because, of course, that got us here, right? The problems that we are experiencing are as a result of folks that made technologies, right, and argued that these are going to be the way forward. So we are at a spot now with the climate crisis where we're going to see more and more claims that we have to do something now, and we're going to have to sacrifice this for, you know, progress with climate change. And again, it's who's going to sacrifice it. It's sacrificing nature to solve the problems that we've created. And yeah, it's shocking that there is this acceptance of bird shredders, right? And not really a concerted effort at reducing the number of electrical cars on the goddamn road. We need to stop. We don't need to build more cars, period, right? It's like, it's driving me nuts here. This consumption dimension that we don't have to change consumption. All we need to do is change technology. And that's sort of that struggle that we're in right now is that I'm not questioning that growth imperative.
So we have thank you for that. And we have 2 minutes left. Can you, if people want to help with this particular struggle, what can they do? And if people are facing a similar struggle or an analogous struggle wherever they live, what can they do?
Well, we have put together some resources on wind power for those communities that are considering these projects or faced with projects that are being thrown or forced at them. So there is a Facebook site, Facecrack, and it's one of those things that are necessary evils for organizing. And you can go to it's called North Coast Climate Justice Coalition, and that's in Facebook. And we'll be posting resources there with scientific papers that outline some of those impacts of wind and other really important issues that communities should be looking at when offered wind projects. So that's one of the places that you can go. And they could also, if they want, get a hold of me, and you can find me via email, and I could give the email if that's something.
Sure.
Yeah, it's just my name at gmail.com, a nice generic Anthony Silvaggio at gmail.com.
And there's a dot in between Anthony and Silvaggio, isn't there?
Yes, actually it's Anthony V. Silvaggio.
Dot there?
No dot. Anthony V. Silvaggio at gmail.com.
Gmail. So I'm going to ask you, do you have anything else you want to say? Because I have something I want you to close with. So do you have anything else to say first?
I'm trying to think of important and interesting points to make about wind projects. I think one point I really want to make is that it's difficult when getting into coalition work and alliance work. I'll be honest with you that it was, you know, kind of it was not devastating, but it was really difficult to accept that we lost a coalition partner just last week, and that, you know, recognizing that people are representing particular interests. But I think there's the importance of maintaining solidarity with one another in these struggles, and it's really critical that we don't lose sight of the goal, and that is, you know, ecological sustainability and community sustainability, and stay together in that fight. We have to not, you know, leave each other to fight these battles alone. So, yeah, I just.
Well, that leads to what I'd like for you to end with is Joe Hill's famous line about mourning and organizing.
So you would like me to do what, Derek? I'm sorry.
Sorry. I would like for you to deliver Joe Hill's famous line about organizing. You know, when don't mourn, organize.
Yeah, don't mourn, organize, and that's exactly what we're doing this Sunday or this Saturday is we are having a huge rally in these communities to show public opposition to this project. Even though it may not go our way, we're going to be out there voicing our solidarity with indigenous folks in the community and the critters. And then we're going to carry that over into the Board of Supervisors meeting, which they actually had to relocate because the number of people that are going to be there, they knew it was going to be hundreds of people. So that's what we're doing, and just keep on organizing. Yes, sir.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Tony Salvaggio. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.